Hello and welcome to the Doctor Family podcast with me, Dr. David Stokes, and I'm very pleased to introduce for the first time, Dr. Nina Stokes.
Hello.
I'm also very happy to report that within the last couple of weeks since our last podcast, we have been number one medical podcast in Azerbaijan. We are delighted with the response we've had from our listeners, both on Facebook and our webpage. And the comments that have been coming in, it's been fabulous. I really appreciate all of the input we've had. And today's show is, in fact, by popular request. Yes, you have been putting in some of your thoughts on what you'd like to hear about, and we've been putting together this bespoke podcast.
So today we'll be going on a journey. We'll be going back in time, back to our very first jobs after we qualified to find out how we saved lives with a sticker. And then, believe it or not, even further back into 19th century Germany, where sausages had the power to kill or cure. But before any of that, let's first hear from a listener who's experienced the condition that we'll be exploring today.
So I was working with a theatre show at the time called Stomp on the world tour. We'd gone from Europe out to Caracas. We had a 2-week stint out in Caracas, and I had been out in Caracas for a couple of weeks. And towards the end of my stay, I developed a kind of a coldy, flu-y kind of, you know, something. It wasn't stopping me from going to work, but it was making me feel pretty dire. So I definitely had a virus just beforehand. And then on the last days, we had a couple of days holiday. So the promoter flew us out to a lovely kind of a game reserve called Les Rocs. And it was beautiful there. And we were swimming and snorkeling there. And I almost didn't go because I wasn't feeling brilliant, but probably got a bit of sunburn there and a bit dehydrated. So the next day, we hopped on a flight from Caracas to Rome via Milan. Didn't really move much on the flight. Maybe got up twice, 9-hour flight. It was the usual economy class long-haul travel. You're cramped. You're finding any way that's comfortable. Landed in Rome. Felt my ankles were swollen. Thought that I'd just put them under the seat in front bit of the wrong way, just maybe so I pulled something. The next day, got up much more severe pain, big swelling, couldn't see my ankles, very red, angry kind of swelling. That morning, I was running around TV studios for some publicity stuff, which probably wasn't the best thing to do. And that afternoon, I had some free time before we started working in the evening. And so I got the promoter. We went to get a massage, first of all, and then to a physio, because we thought I'd pulled something. And Stomp has regular access to those, being a very physical show. And couldn't figure out what was wrong. So I went to the Rome University Hospital. But by that time, real pain. The doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I had x-rays, all of that kind of stuff. And the reaction of the doctor there was, right, just as a precaution, we're going to immobilize both legs. And so I was lying on a bed. He literally had the plaster cast stuff in his hands, and the door was open behind him, and another doctor walked past. My guy said to the doctor, come and have a look at this. The doctor that came in fresh to the scene, so to speak. And the next thing I knew, heart monitors attached. I was admitted into hospital, and I didn't understand what was wrong. Because I didn't speak Italian, and I didn't have a translator. I kept on hearing the words thrombosi or something akin to that. And so I had an inkling, and I was admitted into intensive care, and I was admitted for 10 days all in all. So over the 10 days, I was put onto a low dose of heparin, and 4 days later, that hadn't had any effect. And so they put me onto a higher dose of heparin. I was bedbound. My insurance company said, you've got to get your bloods to a certain level. So I was just willing them to get to that level so I could get shipped home.
Thank you very much, Nick. As you've probably gathered, Nick developed deep vein thromboses, or blood clots, in both legs. And today's podcast is all about blood clots. Big ones, small ones, blood clots caught in inconvenient parts of the body.
As we've heard from Nick, sometimes it can be quite difficult to realise this is what's going on. So let's take a look at some of the symptoms and signs that might indicate that this could be a problem.
I think that's a great idea. So let's look to start with at the symptoms of a deep vein thrombosis, particularly in the leg. The sorts of things that we tend to look out for are throbbing or cramping pain, generally in one leg, but rarely, as we've heard, it can come in both. Generally in the calf or thigh. You can get swelling of the leg. But again, rarely both, if both are affected. You can get warm skin around the painful area, and that sometimes is something which makes it difficult for a doctor to tell between, for example, an infection or a DVT. You can also get swollen veins on the limb, which sort of can be hard or sore when you touch them. which can mirror other conditions, so it's always very difficult to tell whether it is a DVT or not. We'd often need to go and do a little bit more investigation before we could rule one in or out.
Yes, I think in my experience, I'm often being called out to try and distinguish between skin infections in the leg and a deep vein thrombosis. And that's because they can look similar in that when you get that clot in the leg, what's happening is the blood builds up and the pressure builds up in the leg. So the leg starts to swell. That's why it gets bigger. And with the increased blood in there, it can also look pink and becomes tender because of the pressure, and the veins are there because the blood is trying to find other ways to get back to the heart and complete the circulation around the body.
Whereas an infection can cause a similar set of signs to be seen, but through but a different mechanism.
For different reasons, yeah.
So the other clot that we want to just mention, although it's not one that happily for Nick, he didn't experience, and that's the pulmonary embolism where the blood clot gets lodged within the lungs.
And I think it's fair to say that the clots usually begin in the deep veins of the legs and then parts of them break off and start travelling around the body. They get back to the heart and then get pumped out of the heart into the circulation going to the lungs. And then because those vessels get smaller, that's when they get stuck.
And it's something that we really need to be capturing early. They can be quite subtle, similar to the way that they're describing some of the patients with COVID-19 feeling themselves getting short of breath without really realizing it. I have seen a couple of patients who've come to me with shortness of breath without really having much else going on, and that has turned out to be a PE. The other things that people can sometimes complain of with a pulmonary embolism is this pain within the chest, having the difficulty breathing, and occasionally it can lead to things like coughing up blood. And sometimes, of course, you need to then look down at their legs and see whether they've got a swollen leg and it's a DVT that's been behind it in the first place.
All good points to raise.
So before we go on further, I think perhaps if we were to look into why does blood clot in the first place, perhaps we could explore that a little bit.
Well, if we just try and keep things simple and we think about the purpose of the blood clot in the body, then we need to think about it as part of the body's defence mechanism. I mean, every time we cut ourselves, we need a means to not just lose all our blood in a puddle on the floor. And clotting obviously does do that by blocking that cut and blocking the way out. And in doing that, it also stops bugs getting in. Our skin is a big barrier for all of the bugs that are in the outside world getting into our bodies and causing illness. And if that barrier is breached with a cut, then we're at risk and we need a way of blocking that process. So clotting is doing that for us.
Forms that nice healthy scab on the outside, keeping the nasties out.
Which you shouldn't pick, of course.
No,
because you're undoing all the good work.
So how does it actually do it? How does a blood clot work? What's the mechanism for
it? Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think blood, you know, looks like a red liquid and a bit scary, and it causes people to faint. But it's actually an incredible cocktail of all kinds of different things. We know that it's full of the cells that carry oxygen around our body, but also the cells of our immune system that are patrolling, ready to fight infection. But also in the liquid is a mysterious mixture of things that are known as clotting factors. There's 12 of them, and they're just there, sitting there in balance, not doing anything, until they come across a trigger. And then the trigger causes a reaction that's rather like a whole line of dominoes. And one thing leads to another, and the end result is something called fibrin. And fibrin is a substance that can stick to itself, and it's able to form strands and ultimately a kind of mesh and a net that can stick down and seal off the damage. So clotting is a good thing, generally, as it is part of the way that we're supposed to operate. But as with so many things in medicine, good things in the wrong place at the wrong time can be bad.
As you've said, you know, clots can be involved in lots of other medical conditions as well.
All sorts of medical conditions. When they're in the wrong place, they're causing heart attacks, they're causing strokes. We've talked about DVTs and PEs that we're focusing on today. So it's serious stuff.
And if we think back to when we first started as doctors, there was a big push to recognise the risk of people developing a clot and to do something about preventing it happening to our patients, particularly in hospital, although I suspect it was happening elsewhere. And interestingly, when I was preparing for this podcast, I looked to see what the statistics were on blood clots, and the ones that I could find showed that there were 2,300 deaths from pulmonary embolism in 2012, which is not the most recent date, but is what I could find on the British Lung Foundation's website. But interestingly, when we first qualified as doctors, it was actually 30% higher than that. So I suspect that some of the initiatives that were brought about at the time when we started have had a significant impact on the numbers of people sadly dying from pulmonary embolism. So
that's quite a short amount of time, isn't it? So in the 4 years from when we qualified in 2008 to when these statistics were reported, there had been a drop in it by a third of people dying from pulmonary embolus.
Absolutely.
And that, I mean, that does take me back, because I remember that message becoming really, really clear when we were on the wards. I also remember very clearly sitting down with piles and piles of drug charts and applying stickers to every single one, which was writing people up for a daily dose of a blood thinner. Is that, do you
That's
remember
right,
that
yeah, absolutely. And I still remember the way we were sort of lectured on the importance of it, because a number of factors that can increase the risk of you picking up a blood clot are very common for most of the patients who are inpatients in a hospital at any time. Things like immobility, infection or inflammation, or having had recent surgery, all of which can increase the risk of having a blood clot.
So we were doing risk assessments, or that was what was on the sticker, was a guide to who should have this. But as you've just highlighted, being in bed, being ill, or having surgery, which was basically everyone in hospital, means you need this dose. So we were pretty busy.
We sure were. And I was very grateful for those stickers that saved my poor tired hands from using my very illegible signature on so many drug charts. So I think if we go back to when we were actually at medical school, we learnt about the things that do tip people over to increasing the risk of having a blood clot. We talked about those in terms of the immobility and illness, etc. But the initial work that was done on this was by an interesting German physician from the 19th century called Virchow. Well, we've always called him Virchow, but I'm going to play in now a colleague of mine from Germany who corrected my pronunciation.
It's Virchow, which is Rudolf Virchow, father of German pathology.
So Virchow described what he called his triad, three basic principles that increase the risk of forming a blood clot. One was hypercoagulability. So this is tipping the balance more towards stickier blood, the blood being more prone to becoming clotted. There are hemodynamic changes, which is his second point, and that's really where there isn't smooth flow, where the blood is pooling or not flowing as freely as it was, it's more likely to clot. And then the third of these three factors was damage to the blood vessel walls, which we know now, he didn't know at the time, was indeed one of the triggering factors for the clotting cascade, is released by damage to the blood vessel wall, which makes inherent sense if you're thinking about, if you cut yourself, you want that signal to be transmitted, and exposing the internal workings of the blood vessel wall is clearly going to be one of those potential triggers.
So while we're on the subject, I think it's worth just spending a little bit more time taking a look at Virchow's life and his contribution to medicine. So he was actually quite an incredible man.
That's what I've heard.
He produced over 2,000 medical writings during his lifetime and became known as the Pope of Medicine. As well as describing the causes of DVT and PE, he also was the first to describe leukemia after looking under the microscope at blood. He contributed to the field of forensics by developing a way of analysing hair, and he came up with the first systematic method of post-mortem. He worked for social change to fight poverty and disease and was anti-racist, debunking a lot of the pseudoscience that was being used as a justification for these beliefs at that time. He also spent a considerable amount of time on parasitology, and it was very lucky that he did. At the time, parasitic infections were common, particularly foodborne infections, the likes of trichinella coming from meat such as pork. So I'm going to give you the gory details on trichinella and how you get it. So it comes from cysts that are present in undercooked meat. And when you eat the meat, the cysts hatch out in your stomach into larvae, and the larvae burrow into the walls of the small intestine, where they turn into adult worms. About a week later, the female worms produce larvae, which then go on to burrow their way and find their way to your voluntary muscles, the muscles that control the movements of your arms and legs. And once they're there, they cause severe inflammation.
It's just a pretty nasty effect on the body as a whole by the sounds of things.
Well, the idea of things burrowing through to vastly different organs and parts of the body is absolutely revolting, quite frankly. With the infection in the stomach, it can cause nausea, cramps, vomiting and diarrhea. And then, as mentioned, once the infection gets to the muscles, then the body itself tries to fight it with the immune system. And then that causes inflammation, which causes aching and tiredness and sore muscles.
I'm pleased to say that thanks to Virchow, his work led to a significant change in the way that meat hygiene was managed, such that I don't think I've ever even heard of a case of trichinella since I've been qualified. And again, the hygiene of meat has changed so significantly as a result of the work done by Virchow. Probably the thing I'm most grateful to him, if I'm honest.
So I think with this work, he will have saved many, many lives. But perhaps importantly, he also managed to save his own.
Ah, are we talking about the sausage duel of 1865?
We are indeed talking about the sausage duel of 1865. Now, as he was, you know, he certainly dabbled in many things, more than dabbled, one might say. And politics was also one of the things he took an interest in. So much so, he managed to annoy Otto von Bismarck. And they fell out over how much money should be spent on the navy. Various military endeavours, Bismarck being very much in favour of pouring large amounts of money into the military, and Virchow being less keen, perhaps preferring to spend it on other things such as health. Anyway, Otto was so outraged by this, he challenged Virchow to a duel. Virchow sat there and thought to himself, you know, he was a very busy man. He didn't actually have a lot of time for fencing or pistol skills. So he thought long and hard, and he decided that as the challenged party, he was able to choose his weapons. And as it was, when Otto's assistant arrived to further the challenge, Virchow produced two sausages and said, "These are my weapons of choice. If Prince Otto would do me the honour of selecting the sausage he would like to eat, I will eat the other. They both look alike, but one is laced with trichinella and the other one is perfectly wholesome." The second wondered what his master might think of all of this, and lo and behold, the message was received.
Let's call the whole thing off. Sensible chap. So that was a fascinating, fascinating trip back into history.
It was. It was also a rather big tangent, so I do feel at this point we need to bring it back. Why don't we just recap over some of the risk factors that we've talked about, and perhaps talk about some of the other relevant ones that we'll be looking out for when we're in general practice.
Okay.
We covered immobility.
That's obviously a big one.
Being on a long-haul flight, for example, classic. Being unwell, and also surgery. But the other big ones, of course, smoking, obesity, pregnancy, and being on certain hormonal contraceptives or HRT.
So these are all things that can increase people's background risk of developing a clot, and they would also be things that we'd be looking at as a doctor to help us decide what the likelihood of someone having a clot might be if they turn up with some of these signs which we've described as being fairly non-specific.
If we look at that, now we know about Virchow and his triad, we can see why that would be. We know that smoking causes damage to the vessel walls,
absolutely,
for example. Pregnancy, the hormonal effects of pregnancy, tips the blood slightly in favour of clotting as a way of preparing for the birth of the baby and the birth of the placenta so that the mother doesn't lose too much blood. And of course, taking in extra hormones or through the contraceptive pill and HRT can mimic that effect.
There are some other ones as well. If you've had a previous clot, that increases your risk of having a subsequent clot. Other risk factors can include certain genetic factors. There's a condition called factor 5 Leiden. The other big one is cancer. And certainly when we identify people as having had a clot, unless we've got a very clear reason for why they've had a clot, such as in Nick's case with the immobility, we always want to make sure that we're not missing something else. So often people who've had a clot will be going to screen them for cancers that could have caused an increased risk of having a clot in the first place.
If you think you might have a DVT, what can you expect?
So first things first, you need to see a doctor straight away. The sorts of things you would expect would be for the doctor to examine you, examine your leg, They'd probably be measuring with a tape measure and feeling whether you've got tenderness in certain areas. They may or may not do a blood test. There's no brilliant test for blood clots. So the mainstay of investigation is if it's thought that clinically, when they look at you, that this could be a clot, then you're likely to have some form of blood thinners given to you there and then an arrangement for a scan to take place at some point in the future.
Okay, so you might get the treatment before you've had the definitive diagnosis.
Yes, it's one of those cases where you really want to make sure that you're keeping people safe. The risk, as we said at the beginning with a DVT, apart from having a fat and painful leg, it really is the risk of the clot breaking off and getting its way into the lung, which can, of course, be fatal.
Right.
So we would always try and, if we think there is a significant risk of having a clot, then unless you've got a very strong risk from having the treatment for it, we're likely to give you something to thin the blood and reduce that risk.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about the treatments that people go on for this.
Okay, so as we heard with Nick, there are injectable treatments which are given and they work pretty quickly. And that's the sort of medication that's given to patients who are inpatients, as we mentioned at the beginning as well, where we were first doctors writing up lots and lots of these injections for our patients. However, if you have had a clot and people have recognised that, then you're going to want to be on something to thin the blood for a significant length of time. A minimum is generally 6 months. And that would often be in the form of either warfarin, was a drug that was initially invented as a rat poison that is actually very effective at thinning the blood and preventing clots forming and helps break down clots that have happened already. But unfortunately with that one, it does require quite a bit of tweaking about. Again, as you get to regular blood tests and the dosages of the drug need to be changed on a regular basis for a lot of people. Then there are the more modern drugs called DOACs, or directly acting oral anticoagulants. And they are tablets that are taken every day at one dose for you that you don't have to change. And that seems to be a little bit more convenient for a lot of our patients. And it seems to be what a lot of the people are now being given once they have a clot found.
So it doesn't require the monitoring that's required with warfarin.
Absolutely. It's a lot more convenient. Mm. So before we go further, I think now might well be a good time to hear what actually happened to Nick after he got back from Rome. So you were back in England. They investigated you for potential causes for the clots that
yes.
you had.
Yeah.
You were put onto this medication called warfarin, which yeah. is a blood thinner that yeah. requires a bit of monitoring. You need to have blood tests fairly
yeah.
frequently.
I was on warfarin for about 6 months, and it's a bit of a pain because, as you say, you've got to have blood tests. You've got to have, and they change your dosage. And so you get the tablets in, I don't know what it's measured in, but you get a 1, a 3, a 5, and a 10, and you've got to add up to what you need. And, you know, being a young invincible bloke, I very regularly kind of got it all wrong, and you know, and wasn't particularly bothered by it, but yes, so for a period of time I was on warfarin.
So warfarin seems to be a bit of a tricky medication to manage for anyone. I think having listened to Nick's story a few times now, it brings out a number of aspects about clots which I've learnt from, and I'm hoping you have too. He clearly had a number of risk factors coming together, such as dehydration, a recent illness, this immobility on a long haul flight, all coming together to give the perfect conditions to form a clot. And indeed, he was unlucky enough to have two. I found it shocking, and I was amazed at how lucky his escape was from the plaster room. That plaster cast applied to those legs would certainly have led to an even better condition for the clot to grow from there. And if it had gone from the legs up into the lungs, that could have been a fatal problem. It also reminds me as a doctor the difficulty that we have of identifying and diagnosing these blood clots on occasion. Indeed, during the recording of this podcast, a patient presented to me with very subtle symptoms, only noticing shortness of breath on exertion. Although there wasn't very much to find, I was concerned enough to send them into hospital, where they went on to have a scan and indeed were found to have a large pulmonary embolism. I'm happy to say that they've been discharged now and are doing well at home. I think it's important for everyone who's been listening, if they're going to take away anything from this, to be aware that a sudden shortness of breath, without any other obvious cause, should be seen by a doctor as soon as possible. And of course, anyone with symptoms with rapid swelling of the lower limbs and any of the other symptoms we discussed, such as soreness or tender veins should probably seek medical attention as soon as possible.
So unfortunately, I think that's about all we've got time for today.
Yes, sadly it is, but I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and I'd like to thank Nick for his time today and joining us.
And if people would like further information,
then please do check out our show notes, where I'm going to be putting links to relevant websites, including to Thrombosis UK, which is the charity increasing the recognition of blood clots amongst the general public.
And please keep contributing with your suggestions for further episodes. We love to hear your feedback.
Yeah, so please do get in touch with us, get involved on Facebook and our website, join our mailing list and subscribe in whichever podcast listening app that you use.
Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye. Once again, we're going to be played out by the fabulous music of Drew Worthley.
Che Guevara is on my coaster.